right, good morning. Good to see you all here. You must really want to dig into Ecclesiastes. It is the time change, so yeah, glad you're all here. It's going to be good to dig into this passage in chapter 5, where we're going to be meditating on money. What does Colette teach us about money and how we relate to it? But before we do that, let's pray together. Our Father, we thank you for this day that you've given us life and so many good things. We thank you for your beautiful creation, for putting us in it, giving us a job to do. We thank you for Jesus, who gives us salvation from sin and corruption, and gives us new life. We ask that you would soften our hearts to hear you teach us, that you would guide our minds into how to live well and help bring your kingdom into this world. In Jesus' name, amen. What's that? Oh. Is it switched on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Make sure my phone is off, though. It is off. Good. That's good. Yeah, come on in, a few more folks. Yeah, so to introduce myself, I've met some of you and haven't met others of you yet. My name is Alex Groh. Me and my wife Emily, who's back there, have been worshiping with you all for about 2 years now. Why did they ask me to, come and wrestle through this passage with you all? One is I went to school with Andrew Zeigan, so I have a degree in biblical studies, and I've worked as an investment advisor for about 10 years. So I've got some experience working with money and thinking about what it is and how we relate to it as Christians. So before we dive into this passage in chapter 5, just lay some groundwork and make some definitions. What is money? What is money? And this is a question for y'all. If you have an idea, you can spit it out.
Kesef.
And what is that?
It's silver in Hebrew.
Okay, yeah, silver.
It always appears that way, right?
Silver is money, yeah, good. Okay, what else? What is money? Maybe think of what does it represent? How is it used? Along those lines.
Oh, it's something you exchange for goods and services?
Yeah, so you can exchange it for goods and services, right? It's something that we can trade with each other. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Represents opportunity.
Represents opportunity. Oh, what do you mean?
It allows someone or some group to procure or buy something, whether it be a good or service. It also might represent challenge as well.
Yeah, okay. So it's an opportunity. It's a way that we can, get something that we need or want, and it's a challenge. What do you mean by challenge?
Challenge can be oftentimes people. It's typically a constrained resource. So typically people see it as something they want more of, which in our sin state is fairly natural for us to do. So that can often represent a challenge in one's life.
Yeah, that's great. It's constrained. It's limited by nature. We want more because maybe there's lots of good things that we want to get, but it is limited within the order of creation, even.
I guess an economics 101 professor would say it's the method by which we allocate finite resources.
Okay, yeah. So we have these finite resources. We measure it in money, and then we figure out where we want to put it.
Yeah. And it's easily transportable.
Easily transportable. Yeah, it's portable. It's also storable. So great, all good things. I'd say one level deeper.
You're kind of giving the government's kind of giving you some power. Like Jesus said, "Give unto Caesar that which is Caesar, unto God that which is God." So the government's kind of giving you a bit of its power.
Yeah. So money is a representative of some sort of power that we have. We can accumulate. And then we can utilize it in the world around us. It can make an impact. Yeah, that's good. So those are some of the big things, right? It's tradable. Money is something we trade with each other. It's portable, and it's also storable and measurable, right? So we can count it up, and we know how much we have, and we have some sort of an idea of what that represents. But at a deeper level, what is money? Where does it come from? How do we get it? I mean, just like you and I, how do we get money?
So you mean not stealing?
Not stealing, good. That is a great start, yeah.
Work.
Work, yeah, absolutely. I don't get money from taxes. Yeah, they're taking it from me. Yeah, other people, that's how they make their money. That's right, yeah. yeah, work. So money is this invention that we've come up with as people in order to take whatever it is that we were doing in our work, right? We created some sort of value. We spent our time. We created a thing or grew something. And now we exchanged that with somebody else for money. So now money is a representative of that work that we did and of that value we created. So really at the core of it, it represents how we spend our time and what it is that we're doing in the world, right? If we go out to work and, you know, maybe we're a farmer, we'll stick a lot with agricultural ideas because that's the world that Ecclesiastes was written in. You know, if you apply work to a field, you farm, you create all of this food out of it. That's great, right? There's value there. People need that. So it's valuable, but food typically doesn't keep that long. So you don't want to store it for years and years and years. You can't, like, save up for retirement by throwing a ton of cucumbers in a shed. It's not going to go well. So you want to exchange those. So money is that portable, measurable, storable thing that we all use in order to make it more efficient for us to trade with each other. So you don't have to figure out, you know, how many cucumbers equal a shoe. So it's a really practical, great invention at its core. I don't think it's bad. Let's turn to Genesis 1. The ultimate beginnings of everything, if we want to understand God's design for us as believers, starting at the beginning is a great place to start. So start in verse 26 here. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and every other living thing that moves on the earth." God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw that everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. So within this passage, we're told why God created humans and how God created humans, and it's in his image. So let's dive into that a little bit. What does it mean that we are made in God's image? What does it mean that we're made in God's image?
That
Any ideas? Yeah.
Yeah, some of the characteristics that God has.
Yeah, we have some of the characteristics that God has. We resemble him. In some way, we reflect him. Yep. What else? What other idea? What's that?
We don't live just by instinct.
Yeah, we don't live just by instinct. So there's a way in which we're rational and we're thinking and we can make decisions. We have choices. Yeah. Yeah. So that idea of an image, tselem in Hebrew, it's the same word in the ancient world for idols, which is the thing that they would put on, you know, pedestals and in shrines. And they thought what they believed about these, you know, physical stone or wood things that they carved is that they resembled the god or the gods that they were supposed to represent. So there's a resemblance there. But these things also were supposed to mediate the presence of the deity in the world. So you could approach the idol and in some way you were interfacing with the god who is behind it. You know, they didn't think the idol was the god, but they thought that the presence of the god was mediated through it.
How do you spell that word, image?
Tselem. I guess the English transliteration would be T-Z-E-L-E-M, I think. Tselem? Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
The root of tselem also appears in Psalm 23. So the word that the shadow of death. Mm. Is the same root. So an image is like a shadow.
Yeah.
We resemble him, but only through this, only through a mirror darkly.
Mm.
Just a shadow of him.
Yeah.
Image. And I've always found that root to be helpful in imagining what the image of God meant. I'm just just a shadow of what he is.
Yeah.
He made me as an image, but the resemblance stops there.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, shadow. Right, like we get to be something that resembles, we're the outline of, and yet what it really points us to is the one who is the full embodiment, which, you know, spoiler, is Jesus. And the book of Hebrews, it explicitly uses that imagery, that the law was just the shadow and that Jesus is the one who we actually get to see. So being made in God's image is both an identity, so we resemble him, but it's also a calling. We mediate his presence in the world. So he gave us certain skills and powers, decision-making, the ability to interact with his creation in order to mediate his presence in creation. So how does God command humans, in this passage in Genesis 1, how does God command humans to mediate his presence in the world? Yeah.
Well, he's given mankind dominion, but he's also given mankind these green plants.
Mm.
And it turns out that how we manage the plants in this world has a lot to do with how well we have dominion.
Mm.
All that energy from the plants, from food, you know, just part of the whole cycle. And even if we harvest oil or something like that, it's still from plants originally.
Right.
And so there's this ability we have to take care of God's world, and he's given us the food right there.
Hmm.
Mind the plants.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. He gave us dominion. We know ultimately God is the one who has dominion over the whole universe. And yet he created us and said, I give you dominion. So we get to act on his behalf. And then he empowered us with the ability to especially interact with plants, right? And that's where a lot of this, like, you know, again, we'll be talking a lot about agriculture, because that is at the core of us being able to survive in this world and us being able to care for the world that God created. Yeah, and so it's right there. This is the first commandment that God has given humans. It's here in Genesis. We don't have to wait till Exodus. God has commanded. He says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion. So these are all commands that God is saying, okay, I've created these humans in my image, and now I'm telling them, you need to be fruitful. You need to fill the earth. You need to subdue it and have dominion over it. So it involves caring for this creation. And then he goes on and lists the plants and animals and, you know, includes all of this stuff that we get to interact with. So within this, how do humans resemble God, part of this image? What are some of the things that are pointed out here that we can make connections with, ways that we resemble him? We already talked about dominion, which is huge. That's central. What else?
Like Randy was saying, it's not everything. But he's given us the power to be creative and to organize, to organize things.
Yeah. Our creativity, God, he created the world. This is the context in which this passage happens in. Is God just did all of this creation, and he created all of these good things. And then he gave us the capacity to be creative, although in a limited way. We can't create out of nothing like he does. We're able to create within limitations.
And it's a little bit messed up. I mean, like our language, when God spoke, things happened.
Mm.
You know, our language is so vague and imprecise and messed up.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's in his image, but it's also kind of messed up.
Yeah. Yeah, we have imperfect ways of talking about things that are completely beyond our comprehension. Yep. Great. Okay, what else? What other ways are we resembling God here?
We can love. We have a capacity to love.
Yeah, we have this capacity to love. Related to that is an idea of caring, right? So God has set us in this world, and he says to be fruitful, multiply, fill it, subdue it, and have dominion. When he says subdue it and have dominion, he doesn't mean destroy it, right? If we're made in his image and God is the creator of life and the creator of everything, we emulate him in that. So very fundamentally, at the core of it, we are to look to him to find out who it is that we're supposed to be and try to emulate that and listen to his commands. One final thing I'll point out in this passage is that one way that we resemble God is through our work, and that's related to that idea of creativity. You have throughout this, God is doing work. Right? He's applying himself, he is speaking, he is creating all of these good things. And in chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, even says that, right? On the seventh day, he finished his work. And it says we're meant to consider what God is doing, work. And we believe that to be true because the universe is here, right? But now he puts us here to continue that work, to order the universe, to apply our creativity and our ability to interact with creation, to make decisions, to exercise that dominion, to take what God has already put here and bring more goodness out of it. And that's our work, right? That's at the core of it. We get to, you know, go out. If we've got a field, we can grow some wonderful things, some good fruits and vegetables, and we can eat it, share with one another, trade. We can make what is already there and already good even better. So that's a core piece of our identity. So how does this relate to money? So we talked about money being a representative of the work that we do. So how does this impact the way that we think about money, maybe?
I think there's definitely some people that are more productive than others. So they're rewarded with more power, more money.
Yeah, so there's rewards associated with work, right? There are limitations in the world, and when we apply our work, sometimes it works out wonderfully, sometimes it doesn't. If we don't work, we're not going to get the fruits of the labor. So there can be inequality, and that's, you know, maybe or maybe not a bad thing, depending on the context. Because at the core of it, money is the representative of us actually applying our effort and creating something good out of it, right? We'll use this agricultural idea throughout this morning, but really it applies to anything. There's all types of work that we do, right? But we don't need to delve into that necessarily right now. Yeah, so God created humans to resemble him and mediate his presence on earth, and that's partly through the work that we do. We apply our creativity and interact with the world. Fundamentally, then, money can be a good representative of what it is that we're doing in the world. It can actually be good, right? If it's representing good work that we've done, it's a wonderful thing, because now we get to take that work, makes it easy to share it with others, because we can sell off all of our cucumbers, and then it's portable, storable, and we can measurable, so we can use that to trade fairly with one another to get other things that we need. Because you cannot live on cucumbers alone. All right, so let's dive into the passage in Ecclesiastes 5, if you would turn there with me. And we'll be viewing this discussion about money in chapter 5 through this lens of God's creation, who we are as humans, what we're here to do. So I could have a volunteer read through 5, 8 through 20. Any takers? 5, 8 through 20. Okay, thank you.
You see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province. Do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what's the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. 12, right?
All the way to 20. But if you want to stop there, that's okay too. Okay, great.
That's the way off the street. Okay. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, there was nothing to support him. As we had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This is also a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life, he eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting: to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life, which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with gladness of his heart.
Thank you. Yeah, so let's break it down. We'll walk through this verse by verse and delve into what is Qohelet teaching us about the world we live in and how we interface with money and toil and this idea of work. So in verses 8 and 9, it says, If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. in this section, he's pointing out and saying economic systems in our world have this tendency towards corruption and oppression of the poor in particular. If an official, and really it can apply to anybody who has some sort of authority or power, it doesn't have to just be in government, it can also be in other business contexts. But if someone in authority is corrupt, then probably those higher than them are corrupt too. So he's outlining and saying, you know, when you see this happening, don't be surprised. This official doing this, this corruption and oppression, the lack of keeping justice and righteousness, there's probably other people involved too. And why is that? These officials, the people in authority, they look out for each other, right? They've set up this system. And we see that in the world. We've never seen a perfect economic system where the oppression doesn't happen. Well, you know, there are some systems that are a lot better, and there are some that are a lot worse, but even the best come with this trade-off. There is corruption. There's people, you know, looking out for their own, looking out for each other, using that authority and power for themselves. It says in here in verse 9, you know, it talks about a king. You know, it's gain for a king to pay attention to fields. What he's getting at is that a king is meant to stop these injustices. So within ancient Israel, your field and the boundaries were everything. They're fundamental, right? If you have a family plot of land, you want to work it so you can provide for yourself and your family. Now, if there's injustice and somebody tries to move your boundaries in a little bit every year, maybe, you know, thinks you're not going to notice, or they take advantage of somebody who's poor. Maybe they had a terrible harvest. They don't have food. It's late in the winter, and they're now distressed. People come in and say, well, I'll give you, you know, a discounted price for your field, you know, essentially mortgaging your future because they don't have another choice, right? That's taking advantage of people who do not have the power. So if a field is everything, in your ability to provide for yourself, it's important that those authorities, that those officials actually made sure that the boundaries weren't moved. Kohelet is saying this is like the fundamental piece of how a society functions economically. And when it's corrupt, then everything goes wrong. So why should we not be surprised by this when we see oppression and injustice?
Because of sin?
Yeah, because of sin. Great. Yep. Yeah. So when people are corrupt by sin and corrupt in these situations when they have power, what is it that they're trying to achieve, typically?
Well, sometimes their own control, sometimes their own security in the world. I mean, one of the things that money did was it allowed, like, a tribal kind of situation, which is just a big extended family. You just get up every morning and you play your role in society. So now everyone can be individualized, specialized, you have your own money. You know, you can just make shoes if you want one day. Sell shoes. But then everybody's an individual, and you may not do as well with someone else. You may do better. You're in charge of your own security. So you kind of have to store up your own money, make sure you have enough power. And that selfishness just leads to kind of corruption, and sin nature takes over. And you're more concerned with your security than other people's.
Yeah, that's huge, right? How do you make yourself secure in this world? Yeah, absolutely. And often, that has to do with money, right? Trading money around. I'll maybe let this happen because the farmer who moved this, you know, is just a yard or two. You know, he's making sure I'm taken care of as an official. Maybe I'll turn a blind eye. I want to make sure that I'm taken care of. Yeah, absolutely. We get more individualized, and that's one of the impacts of sin as well. Is we become our own gods, right? We want our lives, we want to build our own little kingdoms. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's at the core of it. Security, they want money. They're buying into this that if I behave in this way, I'll be taken care of, and I'll lead a good life. I'll be secure. Maybe there'll be, you know, pleasures or a lack of pain that I can purchase with that money. Let's dive into the next section in Ecclesiastes 5:10. It says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is hevel." So he says it right there. Can money bring us satisfaction in life? No. Well, okay, there we go. We can close the book. It's really easy. Don't look.
Rent it for a while.
Yeah. There you go. It can rent it. Yeah. So it can buy us some pleasures, some short-term fun, some temporary things. Absolutely. But he says it right there. He makes this statement. This is not even him like questioning. And it's coming right off of this. Big picture, let's look at economic systems and we see how they get corrupted. And why are they getting corrupted? Because people are looking for money as this central thing. Really, the extension of that is security. And he says that's not it. And in particular, I'll point out, he says it's the love of money, too. Because again, money is just a representative of hopefully other valuable things we've done through our work, right? So it's not bad in and of itself, but there is this love of money, and it will not satisfy. Then he goes down into the next verses, 11 through 17, and he gives us the reasons why. Why will money not satisfy, ultimately? So verse 11, "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes?" So wealth starts to control the person who has it. Wealth comes with its own concerns and worries. It occupies your mind. You have to figure out what to do with it. You have to protect it from being stolen or taken from you. It increases all of these things, and it can kind of take a life of its own. So you may think that you control it, but actually it starts to control what you do and what you think about. Verse 12. "Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep." So why will the love of money not ultimately satisfy us? He's saying a laborer, with much or with little, he gets good sleep. You don't have to have money to enjoy good things in this world, right? So here's somebody, they're just a laborer, and yet they get to enjoy good sleep, whether they have much or little. But on the other side of that, this wealth that increases worries, not even money can buy a good sleep. And that matters especially with how you got that money, right? You can't buy that good sleep. So why will the money not satisfy you? If you love it and you're going to get it in any way you can, there are some things you can't buy with it. Verse 13. "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt." So he's saying riches can cause the owner harm. How? Any ideas? How might riches actually cause the owner harm?
Separation, like from loved ones.
Yeah, separation. You can become isolated. Yeah, you're like so focused in all of these endeavors that you aren't spending that time with family, or maybe you are sacrificing time and relationship. Yeah. What else?
You become a target.
You become a target? Yeah.
Bad actors out there trying to get money without working, and they go, "Oh, you got some.
Yeah.
I'm coming to get it."
Yeah, right? And so there's worries attached to that, you know? Because it's like, hey, if you got your money, if you built your wealth through good work, you actually created value in life, it's like you don't want somebody else to just take and squander what you have spent your life working towards, right? All this value that you've created. So there's worries associated with that. And that can eat away at you. What's that?
Banks can collapse.
Banks can collapse, yep. Yeah, so you can lose it. Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually the very next verse. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. So we have this, he's making a statement, the wealth can actually cause you harm. So we talked about isolation. If you sacrifice everything, including your relationships, for the love of money, to get this money, you are not going to have those relationships. And that's not something you can just say, you know, later after 20 years of, you know, ignoring your family or abusing them and saying, well, I'm really sorry and got all this money to show for it. We can't go back in time, right? There's greed, stinginess. If you love money so much, you don't want to spend it. All of those things affect who we are as people, not just our ability to buy comfortable things or safety. They actually affect us as people. You can become a person who is corrupted by that love. And then you can lose it in a bad venture or investment. So here's the scenario, right? You love money. You're accumulating it. It's causing worries and stress. You're sacrificing everything around you to get this, to feel secure, because you think satisfaction in life is going to come through money. And you might just lose it anyways. And that's it. It's just gone. You might, you know, you invest it, you have it in the wrong bank, and it's just gone. And that is the reality that we face. But does that mean your life is over? Depends on how much you love that money and how much you find your identity and meaning in it.
There's a great deal of anxiety in giving it away also. If anyone's ever written a will, and you decide how to distribute whatever you might have, it's like, oh my God, that sounds neat. I'm kind of proud of it.
Yeah.
I can't give him the same share as I give to the other. On and on it goes. Do I give to this, you know, to the Billy Graham thing, or do I give it to my church, or do I give it here, or do I give it to... I mean, there's... If you just go down the list, oh, gosh, who gets the curio cabinet? Oh, that was my favorite pot. Who gets that? It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's worse, and here we go. I mean, this is the very next verse, right? He says, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. Can't take it with you. When you die, somebody else gets it. You know, and we might have a say in how we want it to go to whoever, but the reality is, you spent your life working, to applying yourself in creation to create more good things. Right, you accumulated money, you invested into businesses who hopefully also created more good things, you made a profit. You go through your life, you're responsible, and then you die. And who knows when that's going to be. And then it's just gone. I mean, you can't take it with you.
That brings to mind the pharaohs of Egypt and all the effort that they went through to take stuff with them.
Yeah.
You know, bury it in the pyramids and everything.
Yeah.
And then who ultimately got it?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
I kind of see the good and the bad, though. It's just when those riches were lost to a bad investment, he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. There's nothing wrong with investing.
Right.
The key word is a bad investment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with having children. But, you know, I kind of see that there's kind of... He's saying things that we can learn from the opposite.
Well, yeah, so there is some wisdom into being wise about what you're investing into. You need to be thoughtful about that, whether that's in some other company or even in your own company or your own work that you do. But I think within this context, there's an aspect to where this is outside of their control. Even good investments can go bad. And they can be lost. And there's an aspect with our limited knowledge. You know, we can apply the best wisdom that we have and try to make the best decision in the moment, and yet we can't predict the future. And we can't ultimately control what other people do. So investments do go bad, even when it was a great investment to start. And that's just a reality that we have to face. So in verse 16, this also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? So it's building this on this idea that you can lose your money in all kinds of ways. Ultimately, everyone will when you die. So wealth is fleeting. So why would we, this one toiling away at their life, what gain do you get if you're toiling after money as if it's not fleeting? You love it so much and you're accumulating it and you're sacrificing the present for this imagined future. You love the wealth so much, and yet we're not acknowledging that money, wealth, is a fleeting thing. Whether we lose it, it gets spent, or we die, maybe earlier than we ought to. Money is a fleeting thing. And it's not meant to be stored forever, right? In the same way that, cucumbers, if you're growing a bunch, I love cucumbers, can't store them forever. If you have a lifetime of cucumbers you've grown stored up in money, well, all of that value in creation that you've made, you're actually keeping out of the circulation for the good that it could do for other people, right? So there is actually wisdom in spending and investing there. Verse 17, moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. So this one toiling away their life, obsessed with money, he goes home and he eats in darkness, working until after dark. You're spending everything, you're obsessed with it. What does it lead to? Well, much vexation, sickness, and anger. So this obsession with the love of money and getting it and making yourself secure, spending all of your time trying to do this. And he says, no, it's a grievous evil. This, working and doing a good thing, if it goes beyond what you should be doing, if that is your sole obsession, it actually just leads to a life of stress and vexation, illness even.
Reminds me of Ebenezer Scrooge.
Yeah.
Dark was cheap and he liked it.
Yeah, Ebenezer Scrooge.
He hated darkness.
Yep.
And cold.
Yeah.
Thought he was building up something for himself.
Yeah, he loved his money so much. He had more than he could ever spend. And yet, he ate in darkness. Came home late. Yeah, had his cheese and bread.
And he liked it.
And he liked it. Well, I like cheese and bread, too. Okay, now we'll get into 18 through 20. And this is where Colette switches gears a little bit. He says, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. So what are the things that Colette is saying here are good and fitting?
Well, I kind of disagree a little bit. I've heard of guys that lived in a railroad car and gave all their money to missions and to church, and those guys are heroes.
Mm.
I don't care what anyone says. Those guys, yes, it's good to enjoy, good meal and enjoy a nice car or whatever. But what about those guys that sacrifice their time and their work? So I don't know. Is Colette the good guy here, or is he the
I like Colette. Yeah, I think he's a good idea. I understand your point, but he's actually not talking about quantity here. If you notice, he doesn't say quantity in this verse. What does he find that is good? Because assuming your friends still ate food and drank water,
and they enjoy something simple,
right?
Enjoy a simple life and give their money and. Holes in their underwear,
Yeah.
I think that's, those are the guys that are heroes.
Great. Yeah, I think we're in agreement there. Yeah, whether it's much or little, he's not making a statement to the quantity, but he is outlining. He's saying, these are the things that are good. Eat, drink, and find enjoyment in all the toil. So what is it that we're... Oh, do you have a comment? Yeah.
I keep going back to verse 11 where it says, when good things increase, those who consume them increase. And it just seems to me like when someone starts a business or something. Oh, the business is going great. We need to hire some more people and grow the business and then get more employees, and it just goes up and up and up. And it's like, yeah, it's just increasing and it's growing, and that's seen as such a great thing. But
yeah,
to be on top of that whole thing, like, man, what a burden.
Yeah.
You know, so much better to be the guy that just got hired to be the line worker or just, you know, be the individual contributor.
Yeah.
And not have to worry about the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Money finds costs. And if you're doing something good, like growing a business, you're increasing your costs as well as all this revenue that you're bringing in. And here's this idea now of this responsibility, the worries that come with it. And again, you may be doing a very good thing, right? Yeah. You're providing employment for people, whatever it is, the work that you're doing there. Hopefully it's bringing more good things into the world. And yet, for the one taking responsibility for that, that can be a burden. And especially if your whole goal at the end of it is to get that money and wealth for yourself, that'll eat away at you, because then you start to become the oppressor, right? How do you keep the wages of the people I'm hiring down, and how do I, you know, pay less to my vendors? And
You have to think, wherever you are in the organization, you have to just think of yourself as a contributor at that level, as opposed to trying to get more out of it.
Yep. Yeah. So, within this passage, what is it that he says we find enjoyment in this verse?
The work,
yeah, the toil. This is really interesting, because Kohelet, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, he's saying, toil, this is the thing that's the enigma, right? Like, this is the thing that, it's like, you could work and lose it all. Like, it's fleeting, it's like smoke, you can't hold on to it, and yet he says, find enjoyment in it. And since we took the time in Genesis, it kind of makes a little bit more sense, right? The toil is connected to what we were created to do. There's an aspect to where the way that our minds work, the way that our bodies work, applying ourselves actually is good, and it feels good, and it's right. And you can make it enjoyable. Can also be stressful, because we live in a fallen world. But Kohelet is saying, look, within this life, all of these things can happen, but here's some simple things that are good and fitting. Eat. You know, we get to work, we create some food, grow some cucumbers, you get to enjoy that cucumber, and it tastes really good. Salt?
Put some salt.
Okay, yeah, great. Yep. All right, we'll keep going. He says, everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. So this verse, it starts with something and it ends with something. What is that? He bookends his statement here with the same statement. Book ends the verse with the same statement. You might switch around the words a little bit, but
it's all about the gift of God, and I think that perspective is why he's got this contrast of this oppressive and negative state and then this joyful state right next to each other. And I think it's the perspective difference that is the key. It's the gift of God, says in 18 and twice in 19.
Yeah, exactly. The gift of God. And he even says it in the previous verse, too. And this is unique for Kohelet within the book, that he even brings God into it. But he reiterates over and over again, this is the gift of God. This is the gift of God. So if you're looking at the work and the toil that you have to do on this earth, It's that question, well, why are we even here in the first place, right? What did he create us to do? Part of it is to work and bring more good things in it. And part of that is the work that we do with our hands and our mouths and, you know, the people we interact with. And there's an enjoyment in that, even in the midst of, you know, all the difficulties and struggles that come with that. Then he outlines the five things. He says, what has God given? He's given wealth, possessions. He's given us power to enjoy them. Accepting his lot. So there's an aspect of just resignation, knowing that we are limited, saying this is our lot. You know, we have to work in order to eat and enjoy it. But if we do work, we get to enjoy part of that. And that's within God's created order. So we apply ourselves, and then he lets us share in that goodness. And then finally, rejoice in his toil. And that again connects to that idea of we were created to emulate God in this way. It's both an identity, he's given us the ability to do it, and it's also a calling. It's something that we have to work towards. Verse 20. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. A commentator that I was using to dig into these verses said, you know, what is it that this remembrance or this thinking about the days of life says it has this sense of brooding to it. And that maybe we can read it like that. For he will not much brood over the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy. So instead of brooding, God keeps us occupied with joy. So who is it that keeps us occupied? God. What is it that we are occupied with?
Well, I think the one thing you take with you to heaven is people. You know, if you're not giving your life, God working through you for people, you're not going to take anything else with you.
People, yeah, okay. Yeah. What are we occupied with? What is Colette teaching us here?
Our calling.
What's that?
Our calling.
Our calling, yeah.
My translation says God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart, which would be referring back to the work that he's doing.
Right, yeah. Yep. Yeah, you got it. So we're occupied with something. Occupied. Occupation. What's our occupation? What do we spend our time doing? Whether, you know, that's for money, or whether you have decided you don't need to accept money anymore, it's a hobby, or you're retired. What is it that you spend your time on? Or what are you creating? And you find joy in that. And then again, who is the one that gives this? This is God. And to acknowledge God and to have that frame of mind that we're always acknowledging, God is the one who has put us here. He has given these abilities to us. And he's created us to be in this world to create those good things and also enjoy them. And that's a real teaching. He's not saying that's a good thing. And I think we can affirm that from what we see in Genesis and also from what we see in the New Testament as well. So
Will Rogers, he made these backgrounds for the Vacation Bible School, and I think you did it all your own money. You know, there was a need. Sometimes, you know, I had a need for good backgrounds. I asked Will to do it, and he did it.
You
know, and so you can use your money for good
purposes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So we'll reflect on this. You know, how does this impact the way that we think about money now and the way that we interact in the world? One thing, we can talk about what it's not. So what is the world? What does the world say about how we spend our money?
I think the world would say that the money that we have is our money. I have a closed fist.
Yeah.
But that it's mine. And that God desires for me and us to see that it is his money. And that he's allowing us to use it for this period of time in a way that we see fit, hopefully in accordance with God's desire for us and how we can use our money. So
yeah.
That's the opposing view of the world versus God.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, that's, I think, you know, individually, that's the struggle of sin versus, you know, seeing God as our Lord and Savior and how he has a desire for us to use our resources.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's mine, right? And that's the heart of sin, even in the creation. We take the place of God in our own lives, and we say, okay, yeah, this is mine. And now I get to spend it on whatever I want. What will make me happy? There's the philosophy behind it is just please yourself, right? I made it. It's for me. I'm going to please myself. What do we call that? That's hedonism. At its core, it's just I'm going to find satisfaction in life by just pleasing myself. So I'm going to use money as a way to do that. I'm going to buy the things that I want, but maybe not realizing that money does not buy everything, right? There's now a love of money. If you are seeking your own pleasure and money is the tool to do that, you fall into all of these traps that Qohelet is saying, here's why the love of money will never fulfill your life. Applied to money, yeah, you can spend it however you want. It's a pretty shallow ethic. C.S. Lewis, he uses a ship's analogy in Mere Christianity. Anybody like C.S. Lewis?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Good. All right. Good company. You know, he says, okay, we've got some ships. You know, how do we make decisions? How do we live life? We can break down these decisions. So one is social ethics, right? How do we behave with each other in a way that is good? So my money, it's mine. I get to do whatever I want. And they might say, as long as I don't hurt somebody else, hopefully. I mean, that's a good thing, to not hurt somebody else. But at its core, it's just, yeah, it's for me. I'm on my own little boat. The second level of, you know, how do we decide things in general, let alone how do we decide what to do with our money, is how do we behave as individuals? You know, how do you keep a ship in ship shape? So these are like virtues and morals. You know, what kind of person are you? And the world really might have a couple of things to say about money, right? Like discipline is a good thing. Budgeting, hey, save, invest, but then the rest, after you are disciplined, you can just spend it on whatever you want, whatever makes you happy, right? So we have that second level, and as Christians, we can kind of identify with some of this, right? The Bible gives us all kinds of directions on, you know, how do we interact with each other? There's commands and there's laws, and we can go into scripture about that. The Bible also talks a lot about the kind of people we should be. So what are some of the ways relating to money that the Bible teaches us about who we should be as people, the kind of virtues that we should be embodying with our money?
Well, Proverbs talks a lot about being a good shepherd of your flocks.
Mm.
Don't just kind of, okay, big sheep, just go anywhere you want.
Yeah.
I think you've got to control, add some control to, how you spend your money.
Yeah, and yeah. So you need to be intentional.
Invest it.
Yep. Okay. What else? Think of things.
Oh, you're probably getting to this, but where your treasure is, your heart will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be.
I pray for the missionaries that I support more than I pray for the missionaries I don't support. Because they're getting my money.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, they should use it well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, so put your money in things that you actually care about, too. So there's intentionality. We need to actually care about and be thoughtful about that. Because we're tying ourselves, we're tying our lives to whatever it is that we're spending our money on. Other things, generosity. Right? We're supposed to embody generosity. God in his kingdom, he is very generous. Care, love, and humility is another one, to not be flashy. It's not a bad thing to create a lot of wonderful things in the world, to take responsibility for a business, let's say, and to make money. But are you still humble, acknowledging that really it's a gift from God? The world doesn't talk about that a whole lot. So we've got social, we've got virtues. But then there's one thing about how we make decisions that we've only briefly talked about. That is the question of, why are there ships on the water in the first place? Where are they going? Where are they supposed to go? Right? So let's just say, you know, if they're supposed to sail somewhere, the world isn't going to give you an answer on that, right? This is the question. What is the meaning of life? That's what we're asking here. Before we figure out like what that means for how we spend our money, what is the meaning of our life? And in our world, that question is a joke. I mean, literally, it's used as like a rhetorical question. You don't have an answer to it. What is the meaning of life? It's funny. And why is it funny? Because they have no answer for that. They don't know. They're like, yeah, we're sailing around. I'm not bumping into other ships. You know, I have my money. I spend it on what I like. I'm not hurting other people. Cool. That's my whole ethical system, my whole being. But not filling this in, what it defaults to is just that hedonism. The purpose of your life becomes, how do I have as much comfort and pleasure as possible? You know, if that's empty, if this question is empty, it's just going to default to that because that's at the core of our sin nature. As Christians, how do we answer that? What is the destination? What is the place to which we are going?
God's kingdom.
God's kingdom.
Yeah, filling the whole earth.
Yeah. Yeah, great. God's kingdom. Yeah.
I keep thinking of Galatians 5, and it says, so I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh.
Hmm.
Calling back to that identity. Like, when we're reminded that we're made in God's image, we're not as prone to try to grasp our power.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pursuing Christ. I'll say, this is God and His kingdom. So He created this universe, this cosmos, to be His kingdom, to be His temple. He put us in it to mediate His presence and to resemble Him. And He's empowered us to do it. But He hasn't just given us a list of things to do, like, oh, this is what I want you to do to make this place a nice place. It's actually walking with Him. I love the imagery from last week. You know, what does it mean to fear God? And, you know, Christ talking to the thief, and He says, you will be with me in paradise, in the garden. So the idea of we want to walk with God in this world. So really, where we headed is a person. Not just a place, not just a disembodied, you know, heaven where we then get to imagine that we're just going to be hedonists in heaven. But we're actually pursuing a person, the person of God. And so if we walk by His Spirit, if we commune with God and abide in Him, then everything flows from that. You know, we're sailing. How do we get there? How do we behave as ships with each other? How do we help other ships get to where they're going as well? It's a person, and that person is Christ. So we look to Him. I love that verse. The Sermon on the Mount is full of so much of this, and I encourage everybody to take some time to meditate on that. One of the key verses there regarding money, and really it sets up this whole ethic, is He says, seek first His kingdom and righteousness, and everything else will be added to you. So if this is where we're sailing, then all of these other things fall into place. If we are walking with the Spirit, then we're not going to fall into the trap, right? If we fill this up, it's not going to be a void that we just try to numb with pleasure and comfort. And then the way that we spend our money will also flow from that.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Sure.
Okay, so I was struck by the fear of the Lord after last week. And so I looked it up in the Bible Gateway,
and I only found one verse of the fear of the Lord in the New Testament, in like 48 verses in the Old Testament.
Mm.
So what does that mean? Why is it fear of the Lord more than in the New Testament? It's only in Colossians 3:22.
Well, I think that's a little outside of the scope of this particular topic. I don't think it's a dumb question, but I think Eric would probably be more equipped to answer that. So here's a challenge. We'll pray together, and we'll take just a moment to be thinking about, okay, what's some way in which you spend your money in your own life, and meditate and ask God to reveal something to you that maybe you didn't think about, that you actually do spend money on, that fits within His kingdom, right? His created order, that maybe you didn't realize before. And just meditate on that and give thanks to God for it. God, thank You for Your word. Thank You that You teach us wisdom, that we don't have to fall into these traps and waste our life being obsessed with the love of money. We ask that You would fill us instead with the love of You, and that love, that communion with You, that we would fulfill our created purpose on this world, that we would create more good things with our actions and with our words, that Your kingdom would come here on earth as it is in heaven. God, would You please encourage our hearts with the opportunities in front of us, with the money that You have given us, opportunities to eat, to drink, to enjoy the work that You've given us here on this earth. God, we thank You that You are good, that You, being good, want goodness to abound. And so You created, You invited us into the creation to partake and participate with You in Your mission to make goodness abound. Thank You that You want us to enjoy it as well. I pray that You would give us the hearts and the minds to be able to do that well. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.